It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Lawmakers continue to weigh in on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report regarding Russian influence on the 2016 elections. Democratic leaders now want the full report released by April 2nd. President Trump had this to say over the weekend.
It's a shame that our country had to go through this. To be honest, it's a shame that your president has had to go through this before I even got elected. It began. And it began illegally. And hopefully somebody's going to look at the other side.
We're getting reactions and thoughts on that report and where to go next. And today we're getting them from Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman. Congressman Glenn Grothman is Republican representative from Wisconsin's 6th District. Congressman, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Glad to be on the show.
Robert Mueller released his report to the U.S. Attorney General last Friday. President Trump referred to the report as an illegal takedown that failed. What's your reaction, and do you agree with the president's assessment?
Well, first of all, I want to point out there's a vast gap between the degree to which the mainstream media focused on the Mueller investigation and the average congressman. I don't know in the last 2 years where they've had more than one or two conversations with other congressmen about what was going on here. We all felt it was kind of a ridiculous fishing expedition, and proved to be right in that, but the report didn't surprise me. Donald Trump isn't a perfect man, and he tweets too much sometimes, but the idea that there was Russian collusion causing Donald Trump to win the election, I always thought was kind of a ridiculous conspiracy theory that only the most extreme people would believe.
Have you actually seen the report?
No, we just looked at the summary.
Democrats have demanded that Congress, the full report be released no later than April 2nd. Do you think the public has a right to all or at least part of this report?
Oh, I'm sure they're going to see it. And like they said, the news at the top of the hour, they just got to go through the appropriate redactions, whether they'll get it out by April 2nd or April 5th or April 7th. I don't know, but I'm sure it'll be out in the relatively near future.
What do you want to know about the Mueller report?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how they wound up spending so much money. I don't know if that's going to be in the report, but obviously it was very costly. It'll be interesting to see if there are any clues as to why it took them so long and allow irresponsible media outlets to pretend something might be there for years. But otherwise, again, I'll emphasize, people did not talk about the Mueller report in Congress that I'm aware of, or at least Republican legislators. I received almost no comments about it in the 6th Congressional District. I mean, everybody up here is focused on health care or jobs or immigration, obviously a big issue. The Mueller report, there's just a huge gap between the interest in the Mueller report by the mainstream media, the Republican congressmen, and the average person in the 6th Congressional District.
Throughout Mueller's investigation, we learned of illegal activity involving the president's former attorney, Michael Cohen, who pleaded guilty to providing false statements to Congress. Also, Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chair, convicted for tax and bank fraud and money laundering. Do these convictions concern you at all?
Well, I think Attorney Cohen in particular, and we think he lied to Congress again when he was before the Oversight Committee, which I'm part of, a couple weeks ago. And we're demanding, obviously there's a shift now, the Democrats are in the majority, but we'd like to have, because Mr. Cohen lied again, we'd like to have Chairman Cummings do something about this because it kind of makes a mockery of Congress. But we'll see what becomes of it.
United States Congressman Glenn Grothman is a Republican representative from Wisconsin's 6th District. We're getting his reaction to the conclusion of Special Prosecutor Mueller's investigation into possible Russian influence in the 2016 elections. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler wants to set a date for Attorney General William Barr to testify about the report. Congressman, would you support that?
Well, I'm sure he will. You know, it's just like saying a date to see the report in general, whether it's going to be April 2nd, April 12th, April 22nd. I really don't care. I'm sure it's going to happen eventually. I guess the only good thing about the Mueller report is it finally did end. And I'm actually a little bit surprised that they didn't find a way to drag it out and create more speculation another 6 months. But I guess they couldn't think of an excuse to delay any longer. It's too bad the speculation had to go on for 2 years, because there probably are a few gullible citizens out there who thought there might have been collusion.
How do we move forward following the investigation?
Well, nobody cared. At least in my circle of people I know, nobody cared that the investigation was going on anyway. So it's not a matter of moving forward or wondering what we do now. It was kind of ignored while it was going on, I think. Like I said, I think in Congress, when Republicans meet, we meet once a week collectively, all the Republicans in the House. I would assume it was brought up at least once in the last 2 years, but if so, that's it. I mean, we've always been focused on the issue, so I don't think it'll affect at least the way the Republicans behave.
President Trump has urged somebody to look into the origins of the allegations. Is that a necessary move? And if so, who should be held responsible?
Well, you know, there is speculation, you know, the Clinton campaign was involved out there, and maybe somebody can look into that. Maybe that is a good thing to look into, to see how these ridiculous allegations in this dossier were first put in the public sphere. And I think, I guess right now the Mueller report will be a footnote in history, but I think President Trump is right to say who made it a footnote in history, who came up with such a preposterous theory in the first place. It'd be good to know. And if it came from the Clinton campaign, that would be something that, if not prosecutable, and maybe it should be, at least should be something that we know in the history books.
Congressman Grothman, you've mentioned the media a few times in this interview and how they covered this investigation. What's your prescription for the media going forward here?
Well, I think overall in the mainstream media, I think it starts with the journalism schools. You don't have balance. And, you know, whether you're talking about the UW Journalism School or other journalism schools around the country, I think overall the media does not reflect the public. The public in this country is about one half Republican and about one half Democrat. And at least I'm under the impression that outside of a few talk radio outlets, usually people running these shows who don't have journalism degrees, there's not ideological balance. I think as a result, some members of the media don't know what's important to the average person, because the be it the newspapers or broadcast media, you're hanging around with other people with a left-wing bias. I think it's important for everybody to strive in the media to surround themselves with maybe one half of their friends or associates being more conservative and one half more liberal, so they're more balanced in their approach to things. There's my suggestion to any media people listening today. Try to hang around with a more balanced group of people.
Okay. And thank you, Congressman, for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Glad to be on the show, and always happy to talk to the erudite listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we're happy that you always say yes when we call. Congressman Grothman, thanks for joining us. Still to come, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and students at UW-Whitewater are teaming up to give a boost to one of Wisconsin's rarest plants. I'm John Munson, and for Kate Archer Kent, it's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and students at UW-Whitewater are teaming up to give a boost to one of Wisconsin's rarest plants. From the lab to the lakeshore, we hear about the process of restoring the plant known as Facets Loco Weed throughout the state. Nick Tippery is an associate professor of biology at UW-Whitewater. Nick, good morning. Welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
First off, tell us a little bit about this plant, Facets Loco Weed. What is it and where can it be found?
Sure. So it is a variety of a more widespread species. So there's several loco weeds around. This one is unique to Wisconsin. So it's found only in our state and nowhere else in the world. It's found in two counties in central Wisconsin and then in Bayfield County in the northwest. It can be found on lakes that have a sandy bottom. So it's part of where it grows is in the Central Sands region. And these lakes with the sandy bottom are groundwater fed. So as the groundwater goes up, the lake water goes up. And as the groundwater goes down, the lake levels go down. And the places where we find Facets Loco Weed, they're on these low, gently sloping shorelines. And there's quite a bit of real estate or shoreline that gets either inundated or exposed depending on the year. So that pattern of the water going up and down is actually integral to their survival and their competitive edge.
How rare is this plant?
It is extremely rare. It is federally threatened and state endangered. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is interested in this plant, the Wisconsin DNR. And, you know, it's just, it's an easily overlooked plant, I'd say. You know, if you don't go looking for it, you probably would not stumble upon this plant.
Well, what's it look like?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was about to say. So individual plants are really unassuming. They're kind of a pale green with silvery hairs. So as a person who studied them for a while, I find them, of course, cuter than probably most people would. They have pinnately compound leaves, so kind of feathery leaves. And the whole plant, at their biggest, they're 6 to 10 inches across. And if they're not flowering, everything happens really close to ground level. So the leaves go sideways along the ground. And then when they come to flower, they have stalks of flowers, really attractive flowers, again, pretty small, the kind of magenta flowers. And those are only about 6 feet off the ground, or 6 inches off the ground.
Along with the DNR, you're working to essentially give this plant a boost in Wisconsin. How did UW-Whitewater get involved in this project?
Yeah, so it's a project that predated my involvement. There were some individuals from UW-Stevens Point that were involved. Basically, as a rare plant, it's one that's been on the radar of agencies that are tasked with conservation. And so basically, there was a little bit of initiative already present to study the plant, and the project got handed down to me. The overall conservation goals, I'd say maybe two big goals. One is to understand the plant as it naturally exists, and then from a conservation standpoint, to assess any potential threats. So, you know, we're looking at plants involved with human interaction, and if we identify anything that, that people have done or can do to alter this plant's success, then that's something where people can step in and get involved. Yeah, so I've been doing the project.
Well, I was going to say, by human interaction, are we talking about all the, we have a lot of shoreline development on lakes and streams in Wisconsin that's valuable real estate, people like lawns, that kind of thing. What kind of impact has that had on Facets Loco Weed?
In my experience, pretty minimal. There's a little bit of residential property on the lakes where we study it in central Wisconsin, but they're set back. They're I'd say infrequently occupied. And thankfully, the shoreline of many of the, most of the populations are on shoreline that's already protected. So the state owns the land. There's a state natural area associated with where the Facets Loco Weed grows in central Wisconsin. The lakes that they're on, they're not large lakes. And I'd say probably because of that fluctuating water level issue that they're not quite as appealing for boating. I mean, they're really not a big size that you would take a boat on. So I think they're probably not hot real estate compared to some of the other lakes.
Nick Tippery is an associate professor of biology at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about efforts to restore one of Wisconsin's rarest plants, Facets Loco Weed. So what specifically, Nick, have you and your students been doing with this plant in your lab?
Sure. So this year, the DNR has kind of spearheaded an initiative to try and reintroduce the plants to a lake where they were known to grow before, but have not been found for 15 years or so. So again, trying to maybe mitigate human involvement. There may not have been a human factor to this. There may have been, but basically there's a population that was known to exist and has been wiped out. The populations in central Wisconsin, they're all pretty close together. So this would be a matter of relocating some plants from a neighboring population, essentially. And to avoid impacting the source population, we're starting from seeds. So we have a large number of seeds. Seed production in good years is very high. We're talking millions of seeds produced in years when these plants are very successful. So we have some seeds from previous years, and we've been growing them up in the lab, and we're going to grow them to seedling level and give them a little bit of edge over, say, just dropping the seeds into the ground in the destination pond. So we've been growing them under controlled conditions in the lab. That allows us to learn a little bit about what they need, so the biology of germination. And that would also help contribute to efforts to keep them alive once we get them in the ground.
What kind of conditions are needed to grow this plant?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So it's a plant in the bean family or legume. And a lot of the wild plants in the legume family have seeds with very hard coats. And so they are, I'd say, built to be produced and then drop in the ground and stay there for a long time. And so they actually kind of resist the taking in water and getting signals to germinate for quite some time. And then under natural conditions, as they age or as they get kind of scratched up by the environment, then they would have the possibility for water to get into the seed and help them germinate. So it's a nice natural benefit that the seeds have built in to make sure that not all seeds germinate at the same time, to allow the plants to put seeds into what we call the seed bank. So they're depositing seeds into the soil year after year, and a few of them germinate at a time when conditions are right. So we had to kind of mimic that in the lab. Nothing too fancy. We actually scratched them with sandpaper to weaken the seed coat, and that allows the water to get in. And under good conditions, we've got up to 90% germination. So we kind of tackled the issue of how to get these seeds to germinate and getting them to grow. There are other conditions we have to worry about. So soil type, nutrient levels, water levels. So if you've got a lake with fluctuating water levels, what is really the optimal water depth? So we know that these plants can get, in many years, the water levels are so high that the entire population or almost the entire population gets flooded out. So they don't survive underwater, but they, of course, need some amount of water to get started. And it looks like the seedling stage is a very vulnerable time when they need to get the root system established and so on. So we have to kind of get the water at the optimal level. And I think we're getting pretty good at that.
This spring, the DNR is stepping in to help disperse what you've been growing. Talk about that process and what will be taking place.
Sure. So I'm actually not too familiar with that part of the process, but my understanding is we would be identifying the location in the destination lake where plants were previously, probably doing it in an experimental fashion where we would put the seedlings in at maybe different heights along the shoreline. This year is the third year of really high water levels. So when I started the project, we had really low water levels. And I was fortunate to see a couple of years where these plants were flowering like crazy, really big populations, hundreds of thousands of individuals. And then over the last 3 years with the high water levels, they've been pretty well flooded out. And so if we're going to introduce them to a new lake, it'll be a matter of really matching their location where we introduce them to the part of the shoreline that gives them the best growth. And we're not 100% sure where that will be this year. We have to account a little bit for growth next year. And so by doing that experimentally, putting them at different levels along the shoreline, we'll get some data about that and maybe be able to continue this toward the future. I expect this probably won't be the last year we're introducing the seedling, so this might be an ongoing project.
Well, what's the benefit of reintroducing this plant to some of these shorelines? Is there a general benefit to the ecosystem from the presence of Fawcett's local weed?
That is a little bit out of my experience level. I think from an ecology standpoint, from a conservation standpoint, it's a general goal to keep natural areas as natural as they would be if people weren't involved. So knowing that this plant was growing in a place before, it's kind of a good initiative, I think, to put it back in where it was. From the perspective of conservation, we have to maybe build a buffer against losing these plants. So mm-hmm. they're, if they're lost from one lake, they could be lost from another lake. And so to kind of spread the risk around,
sure,
putting them into a new lake is a nice way to have a stockpile of individuals. And then okay. just ecologically, there would be other interactions. So other animals that are eating this,
it's generally a good thing. Nick, we have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us and telling us about this program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nick Tippery is an associate professor of biology at UW-Whitewater. Up next, the news, and then we find out why outer order creates inner calm. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. Spring is here, and with it, the desire to wipe away winter's grime. And for some, that grime is clutter. And when we get rid of that clutter, it can feel really good. Our guest tells us why outer order creates inner calm and gives us the tools to make it a reality. Did you used to stockpile things you had a hard time parting with, but have since come up with a trick to rid yourself of stuff you don't need? Well, tell us about it. How do you feel when you declutter? Why do you think it makes you feel so good? Are you trying to create order in your space but have hit a very specific roadblock? Well, maybe you'd like our guest's advice about it. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gretchen Rubin is an author who writes about habits, happiness, and human nature. Her new book is called Outer Order, Inner Calm, Declutter, and Organize to Make More Room for Happiness. Gretchen, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be talking to you.
Okay, so you say that getting rid of clutter and organizing our spaces has a lot of benefits. The title of your book implies that outer order creates a sense of calm. Gretchen, why is that? What do we know about how our surroundings affect us inside?
Well, you know, there's so many reasons why there's this connection between outer order and inner calm. I mean, on the most basic level, life is just easier. You can find things, you can put things away. You don't have to run out to the hardware store to buy a duplicate hammer, even though you know you have a hammer somewhere. So life is just quicker and easier. And then also often our possessions kind of give us bad feelings, like we feel guilty when we look at something that we've spent good money on that we're not using, or it's something related to a fantasy self, like, oh, I bought a guitar because I thought I was going to teach myself guitar, but then you don't teach yourself guitar, so you just feel bad every time you see it. And then there's also the feeling of engagement. When we get rid of all the stuff that's just clogging our surroundings, then we feel more engaged with what we have. We use it more effectively. And it feels good. I think people feel like they want to get good use out of the things that they have. And then if they're not using something, relinquish it so it can go serve someone who will actually use it instead of it just being wasted by sitting unused on our own shelves.
Gretchen, you say that managing your possessions improves your emotional attitude, physical health, intellectual vigor, and your social life. How can organizing the spaces we inhabit have such a profound impact on all of these areas of our lives?
Well, you know, that's the very reason that I was prompted to write this book, because it's funny to me what a disproportionate boost we get from something as simple as clearing clutter. I mean, we can all agree that in the context of a happy life, something like cleaning out your coat closet is trivial. You know, cleaning up a messy desk, I mean, what difference does that make in the context of is your life a happy life? And yet over and over, people tell me that when they do get rid of the things they don't need, don't use, don't love, they do feel a greater sense of focus, a greater sense of hospitality, a greater sense of energy, even a sense of possibility. I had a friend who said to me, I finally cleaned out my fridge, and now I know I can switch careers. And clearly, like, there's sort of an irrational element to this because, you know, why does making your bed make so many people feel so much better about starting their day? And yet over and over, people say they do feel this connection. So it's worth thinking about because it seems to have a disproportionate boost to us.
We're talking about decluttering our lives and the benefits that we can accrue from that. Gretchen Rubin is the author of Outer Order, Inner Calm, Declutter and Organize to Make More Room for Happiness. How do you feel when you declutter? Why do you think it makes you feel that way? Share your decluttering story or ask Gretchen Rubin a question at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Gretchen, before we get to some practical ideas for creating this outer order, why is it you think that there's so much, we're hearing so much about this these days, Norwegian death cleaning, KonMari, get rid of things that don't spark joy. You've got a book. There's just been this focus on getting rid of stuff. Why do you think that is? If we hit some inflection point in human history where we're all going to get rid of our junk?
Well, you know, I think that's a very interesting question. I think a couple things are coming together. One is I think the world feels very noisy, very crowded, very uncertain, very overwhelming. And I think many people just feel like, oh, my gosh, with everything that's going on in the world, I need to create a sanctuary. I need to create some peace and order. You know, if I can't control the world, at least I can control my kitchen. And so I think that there is a desire to try to achieve some kind of individual equilibrium by trying to create more order within our own environments. Again, they're not that related, but it's often true that when you feel like you have more control over your stuff, you feel like you're more in control of your life generally. And actually, it often will help you to turn outward and to think about the problems of other people and the problems of the world when you feel like you have mastery over your own things. But then I also think that we're at this demographic point where there's a lot of people now who kind of have it coming and going. So they're in the season of stuff in that they have little kids at home who create massive amounts of clutter and disorganization. But then they're also inheriting things from parents who are dying or downsizing. And so they've kind of got stuff coming at them from both directions. And that's just a lot to manage. It's a lot of decisions to make. It's a lot of emotions to face. And then you got to figure out, okay, well, do I want it? And if I don't want it, what happens to it? You know, what do I do with my mom's armoire? And so I think that there is this feeling of a lot of people searching and talking about, well, what are the solutions for this? How do I think about it? And how do I move forward so that I really just have the things I need, I use, I love in my own space?
So is there a population of people who are most susceptible to feeling the kind of anxiety you're talking about, maybe a bit of sadness from the way their room, their home, or their office space is organized?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point. And one thing that's very striking is that we're not all the same. We all have different challenges. Like, there are overbuyers who want to buy stuff all the time, so they have a lot of stuff coming in. Then there are underbuyers like me. We don't like to buy things, but then we don't like to let go of anything either because we worry that then, well, what if we had to buy something? So we create clutter, but different kinds of clutter. And also, people want to get to different places. Some people really love a lot of simplicity. They want minimalism. You know, they want, like, two shelves of books or a capsule wardrobe. But then other people are abundance lovers, and they want to clear clutter and that they want to get rid of stuff that's just clogging their surroundings. But they want to end up with profusion and choice and collections and abundance, and they want a lot of things on the counter and on the coffee table, whereas a simplicity lover doesn't want that. Again, emotions. Some people aren't that emotionally attached to their stuff. It's pretty easy for them to kind of sit down and think, like, well, do I need this? Do I use this? Do I love it? No, I'll get rid of it. But then some people, every possession contains important emotions and memories. And you really have to take, if you want to go through your stuff effectively, you have to respect that. Many people do have strong emotional attachments to their possessions. And that's part of human nature for many people. And so it's not to say, well, you're wrong to feel that way or you need to ignore those feelings, but to say, given that that's how you feel, how do you think through the emotional attachment that you're experiencing so that you can get rid of things you don't need, don't use, don't love, but in a way that does respect that bond that you feel to the things that are in your surroundings?
I know personally, the older I get, the less attachment I have to stuff and the more I'm willing to just say, you know what, take that to the local thrift store. I'm just not interested in it anymore. Maybe there's something to that. But let's talk about how to declutter. Is there a right way to do it?
You know what? I really don't think there is one right way. There's no magical one-size-fits-all solution. And a lot of times experts want to say, like, here it is. I'm going to give you, you know, the seven things you have to do and the right order and when to do them. But the fact is, people are different. Some people love to do like a giant effort. Like they'll take everything out of the cabinet and do everything in one big burst. But then some people don't have the time or the energy or the even the inclination to do something like that. And so they can do things like follow the one-minute rule, which is anything you can do in less than a minute, you do without delay. Or you go shelf by shelf, where you just do one shelf at a time. Some people want to do it in the morning. Some people want to do it at night. Some people want to do it by themselves so they can focus. Other people want a companion who can help them with the drudge work and also help them sort through the decision-making. So there's really no one right way. And what I tried to do in the book was to throw out lots and lots of ideas so that each person can say, hey, this strikes a chord with me. This sounds kind of fun to me. This sounds like something I can do. I feel fired up to go do that. This other thing, yeah, I don't really feel like that's going to work for me. I'm just going to skip over that. Maybe I'll try it again some other time.
Okay, so if I'm in the one-and-done camp, what's the best strategy for cleaning up the place in just one day?
Well, one of the things to do is don't tell yourself, I'm going to get organized. Because a lot of times people who want to get organized feel this very strong impulse to run out to the store and buy complicated hangers or, you know, storage containers. There's a binder. I don't know what it is about people in their binders. They want to buy binders, filing cabinets. But a lot of times if you use the test, do I need it, do I use it, do I love it? I think that is the most useful questions to ask. Do I need it, do I use it, do I love it? If you get rid of it, of all the things you don't need, you don't use, don't love, you may not need to get organized at all. I was talking to a guy the other night who thought, again, he wanted to run out and get binders and get his paperwork all organized. But when he actually looked at it, he realized that a lot of it was related to pet insurance. And then it was all online anyway, and he could just get rid of all this paperwork. He didn't need to get organized. He just needed to evaluate, did he need it, did he use it, did he love it? And when you really do that, that's when you get rid of things like the bread maker that you haven't used in 5 years. I mean, I myself just recently got rid of a pair of leather pants. I mean, what was I thinking? You know, I mean, that's a fantasy self. You know, when you really searchingly go through your things, a lot of times you're left with a much simpler situation than you may have thought that you were facing. It may be very easy for you to just put things on the shelf and, you know, kind of in some kind of reasonable order rather than getting really deep into some kind of, you know, complicated set of organization.
If you have questions about decluttering your life, how to go about it, when you should do it, why you should do it, any of that, if you have decluttered your life, share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Gretchen Rubin is an author who writes about habits, happiness, and human nature. Our conversation about clutter and inner calm continues. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Spring cleaning is an annual ritual for many of us. Time to get rid of all the dirt that accumulates over the winter. Well, maybe that accumulation includes clutter. Getting rid of clutter can really feel good. Gretchen Rubin, a New York Times bestselling author who writes about habits, happiness, and human nature, is with us today to tell us why outer order creates inner calm. And we're getting the tools to actually make it happen. Did you used to stockpile things you had a hard time parting with, but have since come up with a trick to rid yourself of all this junk? Well, tell us what that is. How do you feel when you declutter, and why do you think it makes you feel that way? Or maybe you're trying to create order in your space, but have hit a roadblock. You'd like our guest's advice on it. Well, we're here for you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gretchen, we have some callers. We'll go to Dan, who's calling us in Drummond. Dan, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Yeah, one of the things that I've collected over the years, over 40 years, has been record albums. I've had different people give them to me and like that. And what I plan on doing through the summertime is going through, sorting them out. And there's a place down at Hayward called hole in the wall that takes record albums, and what I'm going to do is give them to him with the understanding that half of the money will be for him and the other half of the money will be donated to the Hayward Food Shelf.
Okay, so Dan is getting rid of his LP collection. Vinyl, by the way, is actually pretty popular these days. But is this a great example of something that someone's been hanging on to, maybe collecting dust for years, and now it's time to part with it?
Yep, this is an outstanding example of really thinking, if I don't want these things anymore, if it's not giving me pleasure, maybe it's kind of crowding my space, how do I, you know, get rid of it in a good way so that it'll go to the people who are interested in it? You get some financial benefit. You're also giving money to a cause that you value. I think this is an elegant, such a thoughtful solution, rather than just being like, oh, gosh, I can't figure out what to do with these things. I'll just leave them on the shelf year after year after year, even though, like, they're not giving me any joy. So I think that's a fantastic solution for so many reasons.
What is it that drives us to cling to certain things, even though they might sit in a drawer or a box or a plastic tote, unseen, untouched by us for years? What is it that causes us to just hang on to stuff?
Well, partly it's just easier to hang on to things. I mean, like the caller, he had to figure out, okay, where would I take these things? I need to work out a deal with the owner of the store. Like, sometimes it's just easier to just shove a box under the bed and leave it there and forget you even had it. And then sometimes there is the decision, like, okay, I have to go through and I'm going to pick out, my 10% favorite. But that's going to require emotional and intellectual energy of me to go through it. And maybe I feel like I don't have the bandwidth for that right now. Sometimes we have collections of things that gave us so much pleasure in the past that it's kind of hard to say, well, you know what, that part of my life is over now. Sometimes we just, it feels like a kind of a memento of our past self, our past interests. So sometimes what you could do is maybe you take your one very favorite album and you frame it and put it on the wall, and then you're like, oh, yeah, I remember how that was a big thing in my life earlier, but I don't need shelf after shelf after shelf of something that's taking up space. So I think there's a lot of reasons why it's easy to just default into keeping things, which is why one of the best ways to clear clutter is to never acquire the stuff in the first place. You know, even if something's free, don't take it unless you really, really want it and need it, because eventually you're going to have to figure out what to do with it, you know. And a lot of times that takes a lot of time and energy and even money to get rid of stuff that we got for free. So, you want to always be very mindful.
We have another caller. Katie is joining us from Eau Claire. Katie, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show. What's your question or comment for Gretchen Rubin?
Good morning. So I have kids and they, have stuff, a lot of stuff. And so I have decided that one thing that they bring in means that another thing goes out. And I've brought that into my own closet and into the rest of our house. And it has helped us immensely in terms of getting rid of clutter.
That is a great suggestion, and I've also heard of people sort of as a version of what you're doing is they have a certain number of hangers, and it's like, if I buy something that needs to go in a hanger, that means something has to come off a hanger because I'm not investing in any more hangers. So I think that's a great way of making sure that what you have is what you need right now. It's what everybody's interested in right now, and you're constantly, and in a very low-level way. It's not like it's taking a huge chunk of your time to do that. You're doing it consistently over the long term. It's easier to keep up than to catch up, and what you've done is figured out a way to stay caught up so that you never end up with, like, the giant playroom full of toys that is going to take a huge amount of effort to deal with. A really, really good solution.
Katie, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. Let's go next to Pat in McFarland. Pat, good morning. You're on The Morning Show. What's your question or comment for Gretchen Rubin?
Well, I've got a comment. I'm the pack rat of the family, and my wife says I tend to put things in corners. Mm-hmm. And we have an agreement that she just goes through and takes my stuff and throws it away. And I'm okay with that.
Okay.
That's great. I mean, it's often a conflict that one person is tidier than the other one, but it sounds like you're just like, I want to keep it, but if you want to get rid of it when my back is turned, that works for me. So That's a good. Many pack rats aren't as obliging as you, so I think you get points for being a good sport about it.
Is it possible? Can we be too quick to throw things away? One of our producers, Laura Pavin, says that growing up, her mom would toss things out that Laura ended up needing later. She just didn't have a use for it when her mom asked her about it at the time. How can we avoid this type of situation in our own lives?
Well, I think it is very important to respect people's property. So, like in the case of the caller, his wife, they had an agreement, so she knew it was okay. You don't want to start throwing away people's things without asking them, because that will, it breeds distrust and then also kind of like furtive hoarding and stuff. But if the mother's saying, like, do you need this? And the daughter's like, no, I don't need it. I mean, once you see a pattern of developing, maybe you need to have a different way of asking that question. Like, can we put it in a box? And if I find after 6 months I don't need it, then we can put it away. Let's put it in a holding pattern. But if a daughter is saying, like, oh, 10 years from now, I really wish I'd had that, like, Easter bunny from when I was 3 years old, you can't hang on to every single thing on the off chance that, like, you'll reach back into the distant past and want it. So I think it's about striking that balance and also taking pictures of things. Sometimes if what you want is the memory, you can take a picture of it, and then you have the memory. If it's something that you need, you know, I don't know what that would be. That's something that you would need. You know, often you can just go get another one if you need it. If it's something like your journals from when you're in sixth grade, that's the kind of thing that I think you really should err on the side of keeping, because it's truly irreplaceable. You can never get that back if you let that out of your hands. And so that's the kind of thing where I would say really, really examine whether that is something that you want to let go of, because you can't get it back. Something like, oh, I really needed a protractor. It's like, well, we can get you another protractor. Maybe it's a drag to buy it again, but like, if you need it, we can get another one.
I just recently finally dumped all of my college history class notes, and that was a real traumatic moment for me. Let's take a call from Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks. I am dealing with things that came from my parents, like photo albums and things that had emotional meaning to them. And I feel so guilty getting rid of them. How do you deal with the guilt of ridding yourself?
And Gretchen, we have less than a minute left.
Well, it's hard. I think what you can do is pick the things that hold the most memories. You know, you don't have to keep all of their furniture or all of their china, but like one thing that's very special that holds their memory and holds the respect for their possessions, but then you can let go of the others.
Gretchen, thank you so much for this conversation. Our audience clearly seemed to really be in tune with this whole clutter thing, and maybe we'll all get our lives in order. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I'm coming to Milwaukee on May 16th to do a live event. So I hope to see some Wisconsin's in.
Oh, goody. That'll be great. We'll get the place cleaned up before you get there. Gretchen Rubin is the author of Outer Order, Inner Calm, Declutter and Organize to Make More Room for Happiness, and host of the Happier with Gretchen Rubin podcast. Just ahead, Milwaukee is planning to provide doulas to 100 new mothers in one of the most troubled neighborhoods in the city. We'll hear all about that coming up on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.